another kid who resembled his brother Gilroy are sitting in the Arizona Palms in the middle of the afternoon with a woman who is not exactly Elmina, though she is somebody's mother. A waitress comes over with menus. "Where's Shannon?" asks the woman, who isn't exactly Elmina.
"She got murdered. I'm her replacement."
"Guess it was only a matter of time. Who did it?"
"The husband. Who else?"
She brings their food in several trips, each time with some update on the slaying of her co-worker, the weapon, the suggested motives, the pre-trial maneuvering. She interrupts banana cream pie a la mode discussions with,
"Known to happen. Somebody kills somebody they're fucking, even in love with. Shrinks and counselors and lawyers can only do so much. You go behind the boulevards, and you're in the Badlands again, where these people who always tell you how to behave have no jurisdiction anymore, and all the 24 hours Southland belongs to the bad."
"Mom," little Larry wants to know, "when she comes back, will they let her husband out of jail?"
"When who comes back?"
"Shannon. Didn't you hear what the girl said? Shannon's dead."
"That's only in stories. The real Shannon will come back."
"Hell, she will. She will, Mom. You really believe that stuff?"
"Well, what do you think happens to you when you die?"
"You're dead."
"You don't believe you can come back to life?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Well, what does happen?"
"I don't want to talk about it." Gilroy is watching them with enormous eyes and playing with his food, which annoys the Elmina woman, for whom eating is a serious business.
"Oh, now you're playing. Don't play, eat. And you," she tells Doc, "someday you're gonna have to conform."
"What do you mean?"
"Be like everybody else."
Of course that's what she means. And now grown-up Doc feels his life surrounded by dead people who do and don't come back, or who never went. And meantime, everybody else understands which is which. But there is something so clear and simple that Doc is failing to see, will always manage not to grasp. He woke up into this particular season of onshore fogs, and the unnatural rumbling of jets taking off and landing at LAX all night long, as if some hand at a control board had pushed the bass to an unexpected level, and he found the Indian bedspread on the couch where he crashed running red and orange dye from what could only be his tears. He walked around well into the morning with a dim paisley pattern across half his face. Chapter 13. Time was when Doc used to actually worry about turning into Bigfoot Bjornsson, ending up just one more diligent cop, going only where the leads pointed him, opaque to the light which seemed to be finding everybody else walking around in this regional dream of enlightenment, denied the widescreen revelations Bigfoot called Hippiphanies, doomed instead to be accosted by freak after freak, drawling, "Let me tell you about my trip, man." Never to be up early enough for what might one day turn out to be a false dawn, which might have accounted for why, up till last night, he'd always been willing to cut Bigfoot a certain amount of slack, not that he would necessarily want that to get around. But now, according to Art Tweedle, there was Bigfoot's probable connection to the LAPD's private army of vigilantes. Maybe even, Doc couldn't help wondering, to the raid at Channelview Estates. By the time he got to Parker Center, he was feeling like some allegorical statue in the park, labeled Community Disapproval. "Hi, Bigfoot. Been out smoking any niggers lately?" No. No, he was pretty sure what he'd said out loud was, "Anything new on that Bel Air case?"
"Don't ask." "Well, actually do ask. Maybe I need to vent."
The vibes around Robbery Homicide Division this morning were as cordial as they ever got, which was hardly at all. Maybe it was Doc. Maybe the nature of the work here. But he could have sworn that today, Bigfoot's colleagues were going out of their way to avoid them both.
Hope you don't mind if we go take a Code 7 someplace.
Bigfoot, reaching under the table and dragging out a Ralph's shopping bag with what looked like several kilos of paperwork in it, getting up and heading out the door, motioning Doc to follow. They went downstairs and out to a Japanese greasy spoon around the corner, where the Swedish pancakes with lingonberries couldn't be beat, and which arrived, in fact, no more than a minute and a half after Bigfoot had put his head in the door.
Ethnic as always, Bigfoot. I'd share these with you, but then you'd be addicted, and that would be something else on my conscience.
Bigfoot started in scarfing. Those pancakes sure looked good. Maybe Doc could spoil Bigfoot's appetite or something. He found himself purring maliciously.
Aren't you ever bitter that you missed being up there on Cielo Drive, stomping around that famous crime scene with the rest of the high-living heat, wiping out them fingerprints, leaving your own, so forth?
Having grabbed a second fork from Doc's setup and eating now with both hands.
Minor concern, Sportello. That's only ego and regret. Everybody's got that. Well, everybody who works for a living. But do you want to know the truth?
No.
Here it is anyway. The truth is, right now, everybody's really fucking scared.
Who? You people? All them burrito hounds up in Homicide? Scared of what, Charlie Manson?
Odd, yes. Here in the capital of eternal youth, endless summer and all. That fear should be running the town again, as in days of old, like the Hollywood blacklist you don't remember, and the Watts rioting you do. It spreads, like blood in a swimming pool, till it occupies all the volume of the day. And then maybe some playful soul shows up with a bucket full of piranhas, dumps them in the pool, and right away they can taste the blood. They swim around looking for what's bleeding, but they don't find anything. All of them getting more and more crazy till the craziness reaches a point, which is when they begin to feed on each other.
Doc considered this for a bit.
What's in them lingonberries, Bigfoot?
It's like, Bigfoot had continued, there's this evil sub-god who rules over Southern California, who off and on will wake from his slumber and allow the dark forces that are always lying there just out of the sunlight to come forth.
Wow. And you've seen him? This evil sub-god? Maybe he talks to you?
Yes. And he looks like a hippie pothead freak. Something, huh?
Wondering what this was about, Doc, trying to be helpful, said,
well, what I've been noticing since Charlie Manson got popped is a lot less eye contact from the straight world. You folks all used to be like a crowd at the zoo. Oh, look, the male one is carrying the baby, and the female one is paying for the groceries sort of thing. But now it's like, pretend they're not even there, 'cause maybe they'll mass murder our ass.
It's all turned to sick fascination, opined Bigfoot. And meantime, the whole field of homicides being stood on its ear. Bye-bye, Black Dahlia. Rest in peace, Tom Ince. Yes, we've seen the last of those good old-time L.A. murder mysteries, I'm afraid. We found the gateway to hell, and it's asking far too much of your L.A. civilian not to want to go crowding on through it, horny and giggling as always, looking for that latest thrill. Lots of overtime for me and the boys, I guess, but it brings us all that much closer to the end of the world.
Bigfoot ran a deep scan of the place from the toilets in back out to the desert light of the street and lifted the Ralph's bag onto the table.
This Coy Harlingen matter. I didn't want to discuss it up in the office.
He began to bring out ungainly wads of papers of different sizes, colors, and states of deterioration.
I pulled the tub on this, expecting what we technically call zip shit. Imagine my surprise at finding how many of my colleagues and how many far-flung outposts of law enforcement, not to mention levels of power, have had their lunch hooks all over it. Coy Harlingen not only used multiple AKAs, he also had a number of offices running him, typically at the same time, among which, I hope I don't shock or offend, have been unavoidably those elements who wouldn't mind if Coy really did end up under a granite slab, with his final alias carved thereon. Coy's overdose, or whatever it was, there must be a lot of monthly IPRs on that by now. Any chance of having a look? Except that Brother Noguchi's shop could never quite bring themselves to call it a homicide, so nobody was ever required to file any progress reports, intra, extra, non, whatever. On the face of it, just one more OD, one less junkie, case cleared. Once, Doc would have said, "Well, that's that. Can I go now?" But with this new fascist model Bigfoot, the one he'd recently found out maybe he couldn't trust after all, the old style of needling somehow wasn't as much fun anymore. "You mean it would be a routine case except for all this paperwork," is what he said, carefully. Which even just eyeballing it does seem a little out of proportion. Like, the one pink little DOA slip would have been enough. Ah, you noticed. It's certainly the kind of documentary attention dead folks don't see too much of. You would almost think Coy Harlingen was really alive someplace and kicking, wouldn't you? Resurrected. "So, what have you found out?" "Technically, Sportello, I am not even aware this case exists. Cool with you? Groovy? Why do you think we're down here and not upstairs?" "Some internal affairs soap opera, I figure, which you're desperate to keep me away from." "Now what could that be?" "Fair enough. What I want to keep you away from is vast, Sportello, vast. On the other hand, if there is something trivial I can let you in on from time to time, why get too paranoid about it?" He rooted around in the Rouse bag and found a long, speckled box nearly full of 3x5 index cards. "Why, what have we here?" "Oh, but you know what these are." "Field interrogation reports, souvenirs of everybody you guys ever stopped and hassled, and this sure looks like a lot of them for one junky saxophone player. Why don't you just flip through these quickly and see if there's anything that looks familiar?" "Evelyn Wood, don't fail me now." Doc began to run through the cards, trying to keep alert for one of Bigfoot's rude surprises. He had met a few close-up magicians and knew about the practice of forcing a card on a spectator. He saw no reason for Bigfoot to be above this kind of trickery. And what do you know? What was this? Doc had nearly half a second to decide if the card he'd caught sight of was worth keeping from Bigfoot, and then he remembered that Bigfoot already knew which one it was. "Here," he said, pointing. "I know I've seen that name someplace." "Puck Beaverton." Bigfoot nodded, taking it out of the box. "Excellent choice. One of Mickey Wolfman's jailbird Praetorians. Let's see now." He pretended to read off the card. "Sheriff's people happened to run into him at the Venice home of the very dealer who sold Coy Harlingen the smack that killed him, or didn't kill him, as the case may be." He pushed the FIR card across the formica, and Doc scanned it doubtfully. "Subject unemployed. Claims to be a friend of Leonard Germain Loosemead, a.k.a. El Drano. I just came over to play a couple games of pool. Subject seemed unusually nervous in Beaverton's company." "That's it? What was Puck doing at Coy's dealer's place, do you think?" Bigfoot shrugged. "Maybe they had a buy. Any record of him using? Somebody'd have to look." Which must have sounded jive-ass even to Bigfoot, because he added, Puck's file could be in storage by now, far, far away, someplace like Fontana or beyond. Unless, a hustler's pause, as if a thought had just struck him. Let's hear it, Bigfoot. I seem to recall that some years ago, just before he went into Folsom, this Beaverton used to work for a loan shark downtown, named Adrian Prussia. And this dealer, Eldrano, also happened to be one of Prussia's steady customers. Maybe Puck was there on his former employer's behalf. Doc felt uneasy. His nose was beginning to run. I remember Adrian Prussia from back when I had that skip tracing job. Fucking snake, man. Bigfoot signaled the counterman. Chodo, Kenichiro. Dozomoto Panakeku. You got it, Lieutenant. Not quite like my mother's, but still a real trip, Bigfoot confided. Then what I really go for here is the respect. Didn't get much of that from your mom, huh? Had Doc really said that or only thought it? He waited for Bigfoot to take offense, but the detective only went on. You probably imagine I have a lot of status up in robbery homicide. Who could blame you for thinking? Man goes around like Prince Charles, like they're gonna crown him chief any day. The reality, however, he was shaking his head slowly, looking at Doc in this oddly beseeching way. God help us all. Dentists on trampolines. But no, that wasn't it. Not exactly. Okay, Bigfoot. Aware of another con job in progress. I can tell you this. The other night, when we dropped Rudy Blatinoid off in Bel Air, it was dark. He was giving all these directions, whole lot of turns. I don't think I could find the way back there even in daylight, or know how this connects to wherever you guys found the body. But it was about 11 p.m., scribbling on a napkin. And here's the address. Bigfoot nodded. That's just where we found the body. He was staying there as a house guest, and this helps a little with the chronology. Thank you, Doc. Hair and drug use issues notwithstanding, I never thought of you as any less than professional. Don't get sentimental on me, man. It fucks up your edge. I can be even more emotionally irresponsible than that, replied Bigfoot. Listen, there are certain polygraph keys on this case that if I told you what they were, then the only ones who'd know would be Homicide, the killer, and you. Good thing you're not telling me, then. Suppose I tell you anyway. Why should you? Just so we know where we're at, as you people say. You mean, just so you'll have another reason to run me in? Thanks, Bigfoot. How about if I put my fingers in my ears and scream if you try to tell me? You won't do that. Really? Doc genuinely curious. Why won't I? Because you're one of the few hippie potheads in this town who appreciate the distinction between childlike and childish. Besides, this is right up your alley. Listen, we're officially calling it a fatal neck injury. Don't do that. But more specifically, Dr. Blatinoid had puncture wounds on his throat, consistent with bites from the canines of a mid-sized wild animal. That's what the coroner found. Keep it under your hat. Well, now that's mighty weird, Bigfoot, Doc said slowly, because Rudy Blatinoid was one of the partners in a tax dodge that calls itself, get this, Golden Fang Enterprises. Huh? I don't suppose you had the SID test out those neck punctures for gold or nothing like that. I shouldn't think there'd be much trace. Gold is all but chemically inactive, as you might have learned in chemistry class if you hadn't been ditching it all the time to score dope. Wait, what happened to Locar's exchange principle? Every contact leaves traces. It would sure be ironic, man, is all I'm saying,
If it turned out Blatnoid was bit to death by a golden fang, or even better, like two golden fangs. Bigfoot tilting his head and hitting it like a swimmer trying to clear water from his ear. See why anything like that would be especially material? You mean why would the fangs have to be gold, instead of like just some everyday werewolf fangs? Well, okay. Because it's the golden fang, man. Yes, yes, the decedent's tax shelter or whatever. So what? No, not just a tax shelter, Bigfoot. Much, much more. What you would call vast. Oh, and this wouldn't, patiently enough, just be some more of your paranoid hippie bullshit, would it? Because frankly, neither the department nor, more importantly, I have the time to waste on these pothead fantasy leads. Then you don't mind if I just keep looking into it myself? I mean, there's no IA issues here, I hope. No deliberate LAPD obstruction, nothing like that. Everybody's time is precious, philosophized Bigfoot, reaching for his wallet, in its own way. Doc was parked down in Little Tokyo, so we walked Bigfoot to the corner of 3rd and San Pedro and peeled off there, flashing a peace sign. Oh, and Bigfoot, have the lab look for traces of copper. What? Not the kind that goes stumbling all over the crime scene, contaminating evidence. More like copper the metal. See, gold teeth are never pure gold. Dentists like to alloy it with copper. If you hadn't ditched forensics class to go steal hubcaps to plant on some innocent hippie, you might have known that. Doc called Clancy Sherlock, where she tended bar over in Inglewood. Hi, how'd you work out with those two bikers the other night?
They did a lot of reds and fell asleep, thanks. Listen, have you seen Boris Spivey lately? There was a skip, not quite a tremor in her voice. It could have been from smoking.
That's just what I was going to ask you, ESP man.
Because it turns out Boris has disappeared. His place is empty. All his stuff is gone. Nobody at Knucklehead Jack's has seen him.
Doc located a cool, went to light it, then just sat staring at it instead.
Could Bigfoot be right? Was Doc the kiss of death, laying bad karma on everybody he touched? Did you scare him or something?
Now she sounded pissed off. How would I do that when I can't reach higher than his knee? Maybe he owes money. Maybe it's old lady problems. Do you know her, by the way? Dawnette, from Pico Rivera.
Actually, I tried to call her, but she seems to be missing, too.
Think they're together?
You have me confused with Ann Landers. What did you want with Boris?
The guy I'm really looking for is Puck Beaverton, and I thought Boris might have had some line on his whereabouts.
That asshole.
Almost sounds like you've dated old Puck.
Both him and his roommate, Einar. Don't ask me to go into details. The boys have a slightly different idea about what a three-way is. I ended up feeling, let's say, underused, and made the mistake of telling them so. Puck and Einar just murmured together for a while, and then they kicked me out. 4 a.m. in West Hollywood.
No, I didn't mean to
reawaken painful memories. Of course not. It's okay. Just that there's being handled and being handled. And this wasn't even fun. Boris mentioned that Puck might have been headed for Vegas, and I was just trying to narrow that down a little. If Einar's with him, they'll be looking for girls to treat like shit, preferably ones who don't mind too much. Happy hunting.
Maybe some tropical evening, we could play some canasta.
Sure. Bring a friend.
Waiting at the office when Doc got back from lunch at Huevos was a disheveled girl in a tiny skirt whose eyes, after the style of the times,
were hugely made up, not only with mascara, but also with liquid liner and shadow, almost the color of the smoke from a faulty head gasket, suggesting to Doc, as always, a deep, unreachable innocence, all of which sent the throbbing idol of his lecherousness into overdrive.
"Trillium Fortnite," she introduced herself. "They said you could help me."
"They did, huh?" Suavely waving half a pack of cools at her, which she declined. "And how many of them were there?"
"Oh, I'm sorry. Donette and Boris. They said..."
"Whoa! Donette and Boris? How long ago was this?"
"About a week."
"You wouldn't know where they are now." She shook her head, it seemed to Doc, sadly.
"Nobody does."
"But you talked to them?"
"On the phone. They thought somebody was listening in, so they didn't stay on long."
"Did it sound like a local call, you know, like sometimes?"
"It sounded like they were out on the road. A payphone on a frontage road off some interstate."
"You could hear that?" She shrugged.
"It was the way the voices combined."
Doc must have been giving her a peculiar look.
"Not voices. Like parts in a musical piece."
"Serenade for Peterbilt rig and VW bus," Doc guessed.
"Actually, Kenworth in a Econoline van, plus a street Hemi, a Harley, and some miscellaneous clunkers."
This sensitivity of ear, she went on to explain, had proved useful both in her day job, teaching music theory at UCLA, and also for moonlighting as a woodwind specialist in early music ensemble gigs.
"Anything from a double quint Palmer down to a Sopranino Schaum. I'm your person."
Doc had a hard-on and his nose was running. The old cootie food had found him again. Trillium, on the other hand, had dropped into a peculiar silence, which, if he'd been in his right mind, he would have recognized as the Some Other Guy Blues. He found a piece of paper from a yellow legal pad with a long shopping list of junk food items on it in pencil and rolled it into the typewriter, just to keep busy.
"So how did Boris and Donette think I could help you?"
"Someone I know has disappeared, and I'd like to find out what happened to him."
Doc typed, "Lucky fellow." "We could start with name and last known address."
"His name is Puck."
"Puck, uh-huh."
"Puck Beaverton. Last address was in West Hollywood, but I'm not sure of the street."
Now two or three angles were occurring to Doc at the same time, displaying themselves in a sort of hyperdimensional pattern across the piece of blank office wall he often used for these exercises. Trillium here might turn out to be some kind of hired heat herself, chasing down Puck on behalf of whoever had made him afraid enough to split town. Of course, Puck could always be an ancient music lover and running some kind of illicit market in hot Sopranino Schaums. Or, much more annoyingly, Trillium might have been deep into some number with Puck and unable to let it go. Doc had learned by now not to second-guess anybody's choice of romantic object. But who the hell was supposed to be looking out for this kid? How much did she know about her dream boy's job history? About Einar? Or had she actually, this smoggy-eyed innocent, found the Puck and Einar experience trippy in a way Clancy hadn't? And was there any choice for the moment but to dummy up about all this? It would have almost been more comforting to think of her as a contract killer.
"Boris gave me an address in Las Vegas," Trillium said.
"You want me to what, check it out?"
"I want you to come along with me to Vegas and help me find him."
Sucker, sap, and other old movie terms that were sure to occur to Doc in a minute. He saw the hustle in progress, but as usual was thinking with his dick, Not to mention, more sentimentally, whatever the difference was.
Sure thing, he said. Do you happen to have a picture of this gent?
Did she? Out of her shoulder bag, she fished one of those plastic accordion things with room for, he lost count, maybe 100 snapshots of Puck and Trillium, walking on the beach in the sunset, dancing at different mass outdoor gatherings, playing volleyball, running in and out of the surf. It looked like a personal ad in the L.A. Free Press, only longer, and with pictures. Doc noticed that Puck had his head shaved and tattooed with a swastika, which might help with IDing him, if and when. Also, in at least half the snapshots was a third presence, eyes set close together, one side of his upper lip lifted in discontent, managing usually to squeeze in between Trillium and Puck. And this would be Einar, an associate of Puck's. They met in the penitentiary.
All right if I take a couple of these just to show around?
Not at all. When can we leave?
Anytime. There's a shuttle flight out of West Imperial, if that's cool.
Beyond cool, she said. Driving freaks me out.
Actually, it was flying that freaked Doc out. But he kept forgetting why, and didn't remember this time till the plane was touching down at McCarran. He briefly considered freaking out anyway, just to keep in practice. But then Trillium might wonder why, which could be a hassle to explain. And besides, the moment had passed. After renting a bright red 69 Camaro, they went looking for some place to stay, preferably close to the airport, because Doc was hoping for a quick in and out, heading east on Sunset Road to Boulder Highway and cruising a neighborhood of low-end motels and locals' casinos and bars with live rock and roll before settling on Ghost Flower Court, a collection of bungalows dating from the 50s. They checked into a two-room unit in back with a shake roof, a little run down maybe, but spacious and comfortable inside, with a fridge, hot plate, air conditioning, cable TV, and two king-size water beds with leopard print sheets.
Far out, said Doc. I wonder if these vibrate.
They didn't.
Bummer.
The address Boris had given Trillium was in a neglected trapezoid of streets east of the Strip, between Sahara and downtown. The street floor was occupied by an antique seller who introduced himself as Delwyn Quite.
Most of it's pawn shop consignments, but have a look. Half of what's here I don't even know about.
He produced a Japanese stash box of black lacquer and mother of pearl in a crane and willow motif and full of pre-rolled joints, lit one up, and they passed it around.
Lot of Wild West stuff here, it seemed to Doc.
He remembered Bigfoot Bjornsson and his 100 pounds of barbed wire.
You got something I could bring a barbed wire collector?
Not a lot, understand. Maybe a small little piece?
Just sold off the end of my last spool. And it's all Japanese repros now, anyway. But here, you might want to have a look at this. Came in yesterday, direct from an archaeological dig in Tombstone.
It was an ordinary-looking coffee mug, with a third of the top covered over, except for a small mouth hole, intended to keep the mustache of the drinker from getting soaked. The cup was decorated on one side with a vivid green saguaro cactus, and on the other side with a pair of crossed buntline specials above the word Wyatt in that old-time wanted poster typeface.
Trippy, Doc said. How much?
I might let it go for 1,000.
1,000 what?
Please, this belonged to Marshall Earp himself.
I was thinking more like $2.
They began to discuss this and kept wandering from the subject till Doc noticed something over in the corner. How would you put it? Glowing, sort of.
Hey, what's this?
What it was a necktie covered with thousands or hundreds of magenta and green sequins in a piano keyboard pattern and accented tastefully all around the edges with rhinestones.
"Now that," Quite said, "belonged to Liberace. During one of his shows at the Riviera, while playing Chopin's Grand Valse Brion with one hand, Lee took this tie off with the other and flung it into the audience. Autographed on the back, see?"
Doc tried it on, looked at it in the mirror for a while, and how it caught the light and so forth. Quite, still trying to sell the mustache cup, offered to throw the tie in too, and they finally settled on $10 for both items.
"This always happens," the dealer, banging his head softly but expressively against the seed, feed, and fertilizer clerk's desk, circa 1880. "I'm smoking myself out of business."
"The other thing," Doc said, "we almost forgot is you have tenants upstairs, right?"
"Not at the moment. They moved out last week."
He sighed.
"Puck and Einar. A lot of people come and go in this neighborhood, but they were, what's the word? Special."
Did they say where they were going?"
Trillium's voice sliding into a darker register Doc was coming to recognize.
"Not really. No one ever does, of course."
"Anybody else been looking for them?"
"A couple of gentlemen from the FBI, actually."
Quite looked through the contents of a decorative ashtray from the Sands, said to have been thrown up into once by Joey Bishop, and located a business card with Hugo Borderline, Special Agent, printed down in the corner, and a local phone number, an extension, and ballpoint.
"Shit," reflected Doc,
and had the special agent brought his running mate Flatweed along as well, a kind of government busybody twofer? And if so, why weren't they back in L.A. setting spade revolutionaries at each other's throats? Las Vegas would seem to offer slim pickings in that direction, unless, like, the black nationalist story had been a front all along for something else, something aimed, let's say, at organized crime, which is said to own the Vegas casinos and pretty much to run the place these days. But wait, these feds had been in here inquiring after Puck, and what could Puck's connection be to any of that? Doc felt a suspicion growing, paranoid as the rapid heartbeat of a midnight awakening, that Puck's fate was included in Mickey's, and the question to be asking was what kind of business Mickey might have been doing with the mob, or worse, with the FBI.
"During your chat, was there anything maybe you didn't share with them?"
"I did think about recommending a bar called Curly's out on Rampart, but the more they went on, the less it seemed somehow like their sort of place."
"This was, like, a Puck and Einar hangout?"
"Depending on the music policy week to week, that was the impression I got."
"Let me guess, country and western?"
"Broadway show tunes,"
Trillium said quietly.
"And how?"
nodded Quite.
"Puck used to do Ethel Merman," she recalled.
"They both did. They'd roll in at 4 a.m. singing, 'There's no business like show business.' You could hear it coming from blocks away, slowly getting louder. Nobody ever complained."
Back in the car, Doc said, "Come on, I'll buy you an enchilada."
They drove toward a spectacular desert sunset and turned up South Main. El Sombrero looked to be a bit of a wait, with a line of hungry folk spilling out the door of the world-renowned taqueria and well down the street, drooling on the sidewalk and so forth. Doc drove on past, and then around a couple more corners to the neon grandiosities of Tex-Mecca, unknown to guidebooks, but for a network of hungry dopers and petty criminals all along the U.S.-Mexican border, an object of pilgrimage. Two steps in the door of which, who did Doc catch sight of but FBI Special Agents Borderline and Flatweed,
both in the synchronized act of stuffing dimly perplexed Anglo faces with the house's celebrated giant burrito special. Well, Doc supposed, the FBI did have to eat someplace. He searched his media memory for instances of Inspector Louis Erskine ever eating anything, and came up blank. Before the brown-suited tools of justice recognized him, Doc steered Trillium quickly to a corner table, out of their line of sight, and hid behind a menu, resolved that not even a downer like Feds in the area would get in the way of his appetite. A waitress came over, and they ordered a lengthy combination of enchiladas, tacos, burritos, tostadas, and tamales for two, called El Atomico, whose entry on the menu carried a footnote disclaiming legal responsibility.
"Do you know those men over there?" Trillium said. "They seem to know you."
Doc leaned to where he could see. The two agents, now heading out the door, kept glaring back his way. "It's those Federals that Quite was talking about."
"Is it something to do with Puck? Do you think he's in trouble with the FBI?"
"Okay. You knew he was a personal bodyguard of Mickey Wolfman's, right? And now Mickey is a possible kidnap, so they might have a couple of routine questions for Puck, would be all."
"He can't go back to prison, Doc. It would kill him."
She had that lovelorn look on her face. Doc had already deduced that he could be Mick Jagger, pay fees in the range of six figures per fleeting smile, even give up watching the Lakers, and nothing he did would make the least impression. For this chick, it was Puck Beaverton or nobody. Not the first time Doc had run into girl of his dreams unavailability. The thing right now was to be professional, if not groovy, and try to put her mind at rest. "So, tell me, Trillium, how did you two kids meet?" Bless her, she thought he really wanted to know.
"Well, at UCLA, as it turns out, in Pauley Pavilion."
"No kidding. Hey, weren't those guys incredible last season? I'm sure gonna miss Kareem and Lucius." "No, actually, not basketball. The L.A. Philharmonic also happened to play at Pauley Pavilion off and on, a cross-cultural music series with guest artists like Frank Zappa. And sometimes there'd be a last-minute opening for a local Reed person. One afternoon, Trillium showed up at a rehearsal with an English horn and feelings of skepticism about the work in question. Somebody's symphonic poem for surf band and orchestra, featuring the Boards. Puck happened to be working security for the band. He and Trillium met back in one of the locker rooms, where people kept running in and out during breaks to light up or snort coke. She was bent over a sink, looking down into a compact mirror, felt someone close behind her. And there, a little warped through a set of coke lines, came looming Puck's face. He was gazing at her ass in a kind of morose fatality. Before Trillium knew what was happening, she found herself in the back seat of a stolen 62 Bonneville, parked in a cul-de-sac off Sunset, being seen to, California Department of Correction style.
"Chicks say they don't like it this way," Puck explained later, when she had a minute to breathe. "And then before you know it, they're back again, begging. With me, it's just what I got used to."
"Are you apologizing?"
"I don't think so."
He was right about the begging, though. She found herself carrying rolls of coins for payphones because she never knew at what odd moment of the day the longing would seize hold of her. Between freeway exits miles away from his place in West Hollywood, in the produce section of the Safeway, during some fugue for woodwinds, all at once this humiliating heat would envelop her, and there was nothing she could think of to do but call him. He didn't always answer the phone. Once or twice she went crazy and parked outside his place and waited for hours, in fact, overnight, till he came out. And by then,
afraid of his anger, which was unpredictable both as to when and how dangerous, reluctant to face him, she followed him instead out to wherever he was working, and waited, and would fall asleep, and be awakened by the police, telling her she had to move on.
So I said, "Puck, it's all right. I won't do anything violent. I just want to know who she is."
And Puck started to laugh and wouldn't tell me.
But that was around the time I found out about Einar, and one day I was coming out of a rehearsal at the Shrine Auditorium, obsessing about this particular B-flat, and there was Einar, with all these Hawaiian orchids and the sweetest look on his face. And it was at least a month before he admitted he'd worked his way like a pickpocket through the crowd at a debutante ball in the Ambassador and stolen the corsages right off people's gowns.
Being the continuation of a long story Doc had forgotten, or maybe missed the beginning of.
I don't know why I'm telling you all this.
Doc didn't either, though he wished he had a small aggravation fee for each time somebody had spilled more than they meant to, and then said they didn't know why. Sorta Liege, who liked finding new uses for the term beyond, thought this was a form of grace, and that he should just accept it, because at any instant it could go away as easily as it came. According to Trillium, Puck and Einar had met in the license plate shop at Folsom. Sex immediately became an issue, and the boys were soon known for their ill-tempered bickering, on and on about the age-old question, "Quién es más macho?" Numberless cartons of smokes were wagered and lost all up and down the block over how long the arrangement would survive, and to everybody's surprise, it outlasted both their sentences. One fine day, as the chiffons like to put it, there they were, domiciled in West Hollywood, south of Santa Monica Boulevard, in a courtyard complex with more subtropical shrubbery than anybody could remember what half of it was, and throwing so much shade that you could lie out by the pool all day and never lose your prison pallor.
"Wow, Trillium, what happened to our food, man? It's taken them an awful long time to bring it."
"We ate it already."
"What? Did the check come? Who sprang for it?"
"Can't remember."
They headed out to Curly's. By the time they got there, Doc had decided he wasn't going to drive in Las Vegas any more than he had to. Everybody here drove around like a dedicated loser, expecting moment to moment to get into an accident. Doc could relate to this. It was like the beach, where you lived in a climate of unquestioning hippie belief, pretending to trust everybody while always expecting to be sold out. But he didn't have to enjoy that either, especially. Curly's had once been a crossroads saloon and reminded Doc of Knucklehead Jack's back in L.A., except for the slot machines and every plausible piece of floor space. The band was playing covers of old Ernest Tubb, Jim Reeves, and Webb Pierce tunes, so Doc guessed Puck and Einar might not be in tonight. Trillium had a sort of feverish look. Doc was starting to think there was some strange vibe about her, some tattoo reading, "Come on in, darling," invisible to all but the larger, more brutal types of individual. She may have been aware of this herself, while at the same time denying it. Howsoever overstrolled this towering party in a black cowboy hat, who, without so much as a nod to Doc, took Trillium by the hair and one bare thigh, lifted her courteously enough off the bar stool, and began Texas two-stepping her way. You would have thought at least she'd scream and protest, but she only managed to whisper to Doc on the way past,
"I'll see what I can find out."
Doc wasn't sure, but thought she was already smiling.
"You betcha," he muttered, shaking his head slowly at the long neck in front of him and wondering how John Garfield would have dealt with the situation.
"You mustn't judge Osgood too harshly," advised a voice to which time, if it had not exactly been kind,
had at least contributed some texture. The man is a natural-born pussyhound, and there ain't a woman breathing between here and Lake Mead. Don't know that by now.
Thanks, that's good to hear.
Doc looked over to find an elfin geezer in a hat even bigger than Osgood's, waggling an empty beer bottle.
Sure thing.
Doc went to signal the barkeep, who, blessed with extrasensory gifts, had already placed two more bottles on the bar.
All I came in for tonight, Doc pretended to sigh, really was to see this fellow owes me some money. The old lady there thought I was inviting her out for a night on the town. Meantime, there's the rent coming due and so forth.
Damn, said the oldster, introducing himself as Ev. Time was a man would sooner dry up and blow away than renege on his debts. There's a lot of deadbeats come in this place. Maybe I even know the one you want.
Somebody said he's a semi-regular here. Puck Beaverton?
A mirthless cackle which went on longer than Doc felt it should have. Good luck with the landlord, young fella. That crazy Puck owes everybody in town and never paid a cent back that I ever heard of.
Where's he work? Maybe I should go there and visit him.
Puck's basically a slot hustler, him and his partner. This is the impression I get. Though it ain't like we're none of us real ace buddies. The little one, Einar, has these hypersensitive hands you find in rare cases that can feel through the liver, feel the exact point where each of them reels lets go one by one. He can fine-tune the amount of spin onto each reel, get whichever symbol he wants to stop exactly at the pay line. I seen him do it. Classy work.
What about Puck?
Sooner or later, the house security gets on to Einar, so there's no more point him trying to collect his winnings. Puck's job is to wait nearby, playing some nickel machine till Einar hits on his. Then Einar disappears while Puck steps over and claims a jackpot.
But then pretty soon they must get on to Puck.
Right. Which is why they both long ago got 86th from the downtown and strip casinos. So if you're looking to find Puck, you'll want to check some local rooms. Like out along Boulder Highway, the Nine of Diamonds comes to mind.
Trillium came back with a few buttons loose, an unidentified wet patch on her little skirt, and a lack of focus to her gaze. Osgood was out on the floor now with a blonde in Levi's and a cowgirl hat, and a live band was now playing Wabash Cannonball, with psychedelic steel guitar licks now and then.
"Having a good time, honey bunch?" Doc inquired as cheerfully as possible. "Yes and no," in a chastened voice, which despite himself he found erotic. "Buy me a beer?"
She drank in silence till Doc said, "Well, and what's that there Osgood got to say for himself tonight?"
"I feel kind of stupid, Doc. I should never have brought Puck's name up."
"He owes Osgood money, too, I'll bet."
"Yes, and now Osgood is all upset. He's not really as insensitive as he looks."
"He didn't happen to share any thoughts on Puck's whereabouts?"
"North Las Vegas. That's as close as he got. I don't think he knows the address, or he would have gone there by now."
"And that would have made the papers?"
On the way out, they were accosted by Ev.
"Leaving so early? Merle usually comes in and does a set around midnight when he's in town."
"Merle Haggard's in town?"
"No, but there's no reason to leave."
Doc blinked a couple of times, bought the old-timer a Ramus gin fizz, and left anyway. Out in the parking lot, Doc noticed a Cadillac of a certain length whose arrangement of dings seemed familiar.
"Hey, Doc, I thought that was you."
"Is this another of them strange and weird coincidences, Tito? Or do I have to really start getting paranoid?"
"I told you we were going to be in Vegas. Inez is off at a show, and I'm picking up some change. You should see the way some of these guys tip. I already made more on my vacation here than a whole year back in L.A.
And no, Doc made dice-rattling motions. Like under the spell of Vegas or nothing?
Some spell. Look at this place. How real can any of this be? How can you take it seriously?
You're a fucking gambling addict,
announced an enormous voice from somewhere inside the limo.
You can't take it any other way.
My brother-in-law, Adolfo, Tito frowning, can't shake him. Ain't a buck comes in, he don't snatch and grab it before I can.
It's in escrow, explained Adolfo,
who, it turned out, had been commissioned by Inez to ride along in the limo and keep Tito out of trouble.
Low-life Escrow Services, Inc., Tito muttered.
Trillium, appearing a little distracted, had decided to go back to the room and get some sleep, so she took the Camaro, and Doc joined Tito and Adolfo in the limo.
You know a place called the Nine of Diamonds, out on Boulder Highway? Doc said.
Sure, Tito said. You mind if I come inside with you? Just wander around a little, maybe hit the buffets, catch some of the show.
Sound a little eager there, Tito.
Yeah, you're supposed to be kicking, Adolfo put in.
Homeopathic doses, you guys, Tito protested.
According to Bigfoot Bjornsson, for whom this piece of Western trivia had won him many a bar bet, the Nine of Diamonds had been the fifth card in Wild Bill Hickok's last poker hand, along with the black aces and eights. The parking lot was full of pickups, with contractors' racks on them, and Ford Rancheros, with hay debris on the bed. Ancient T-Birds and Chevy Nomads, with the chrome strips long torn away, leaving only lines of rusty streaks and well spots. The lighted marquee out front, a Jetson-style polygon, mentioned an appearance tonight by a band called Carmine and the Calzones. The customers inside didn't seem to be from too far out of town, so the action was less compromised by the unthinking pursuit of fun, as defined over on the Strip. Players here tended to play for the money, going about their business hopeful or desperate, loaded or on the natch, scientifically or gripped in superstitions so exotic they couldn't be readily explained. And somewhere out of the light, the landlord, the finance company, the loan shark community, sat invisible and unspeaking, tapping feet in expensive shoes, weighing options for punishment, leniency, even, rarely, mercy. Carmine was a long-haired lounge tenor with a Les Paul model Gibson that he may have had a few lessons on but tended to use more as a prop, often including Tommy gun gestures, while the other Calzones assumed standard rock quartet parts. A pair of cupcakes and red vinyl mini-dresses, black fishnet hose, and lacquered hair sang backup while doing white chick time steps. As Doc made his way onto the casino floor, the group were performing their latest release. Just the Lasagna, semi-bossa nova.
Is it some UFO? No, 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 maybe it's... Wait, I know! It's Just the Lasagna! Just the lasagna, just the lasagna. Out of the blue it came, nobody knew its name. Just the lasagna, just the lasagna, just the lasagna. Who could ever get beyond ya? Do you just sit there going, nya, nya? Woo, lasagna, shame on ya, doggone ya. How come you're asking me, asking me? Hey, ain't no big mystery, it's just the lasagna. Or so they say, oh, whoa, 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 I'm under your spell, L-A-S-A-G-N-A.
Doc spent a while chatting up change girls, bartenders, dealers, and pit bosses, ladies of the evening and ladies of the later shifts, including a young woman in a wine-colored velvet mini-dress who finally informed him, "Everybody knows that Puck used to work for Mickey. Nobody here is going to rat him out."